was like down in this country with the dry weather and so forth.
Well,
how dry was it down here?
It was terribly dry the first part. Spring, we had a terribly dry spring.
Yeah.
And July, and the haying was very short and very dry. In the middle of August, it started to rain.
Uh-huh.
It was wet from there on.
So you had a very wet autumn then.
Yeah. Some people didn't get their hay cut.
I see, it rained enough to wreck what hay there was.
It really did.
Jeez.
So, a lot of people's hay was lying in, what did they call them? Kind of windrows, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Side delivery rate.
Yeah.
On this part and there it rained.
So they never able to get it?
No, it rained up until probably the 10th of October before it quit, and then turned cold. So we had
a
disagreeable year.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. Well, are people going out of business in this valley?
No, not too many in this valley.
Yeah.
I hear around Montana that the ranchers are in bad shape. But
yeah.
I don't think they are here.
I read someplace that the ranchers here were always a little more conservative in how much they extended themselves.
Maybe they are. Yeah.
Teresa.
Well, I was going to say it's really changed the character of the valley because this hunting sportsman stuff has taken over. The biggest thing we have down here, as far as flourishing, is the
sports store.
Sporting goods store.
Is that right? That's the most flourishing thing in town?
Yeah, well, not really, but it's got money behind it. And if they lose, why, they're not going to go down the road because they've got money. But and everything is...
These big ranches lease their
hunting
rights when their property is. And they bring in people from back east to hunt. They pay as much as...
Well, free hunting.
Well, on the Forest Service land there. Yeah. But all these big ranchers have their... They make more money or make the profit off of the hunting rights.
But what do they charge a guy for it?
Well, now they
do that.
Do
they sell it by the day?
They sell it by the year.
Oh.
And right close to us on Birch Creek, there's a man from Livingston rents it, and he brings in hunters from back east, all over the east.
Yeah.
And they pay as high as $2,000 or $3,000 for a couple of weeks hunting, for a week or 10 days hunting. And they don't let us natives in there.
Yeah.
He patrols it.
Yeah, that's a real difference in the valley, isn't it?
That's this whole mountain up here by Birch Creek. Rock Creek is its lease. Well, everybody's got any sections of the mountain, they lease them.
Okay, that's a change.
They don't let the locals in unless you pay.
Yeah. So is Rick the last local guy down here, sort of?
Well, he's the last of us.
Yeah.
And Mike was he getting the phone calls last fall. Everybody wanted to put their money. We have lots of elk. You wouldn't believe the game, isn't that true?
Yeah,
the game that we have.
Didn't used to be any elk, now there's 300 or 400 in
the
bunch. Yeah.
Oh.
And these hunters come in from back east, these rich people, and they don't kill the cows, they just kill trophy bulls. And that lets the herd increase. Nobody wants a cow. It's not the meat they're after,
right.
It's for the horns.
Yeah.
Or some meat, probably. They take those horns or heads back east.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting change. All right.
And there's a real strong movement toward getting the cattlemen off the public land.
Off the beyond the forest.
I've got a paper. You should take it with you to read.
Well, I don't know if they'll do it or not, but the sportsmen are pretty strong.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose they are. And so they'd like
One of the things they passed over here at the last legislature, they can fish up and down their streams.
That's right, a stream access law came.
We're kind of interested in that because down to the loophole we have a couple of miles of stream and probably 4 or 5 miles by the time it wanders back and forth. And they can walk right down the creek. Don't make a difference. You have cattle there or what you have there. Public stream access.
A fairly new publication out of Missoula, and it makes me so mad. It's called Northern Lights. And that one especially made me mad because he said he'd happily shoot every rancher and every cow.
No, well, that, that would make you...
that gets
your attention.
You
okay. That gets your attention out here, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Well,
All right.
I'm not much of a Missoula person, so because our kids went to Bozeman.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Some
really
nutty things come out of the school. I shouldn't say that. That's where you went to school.
No, I didn't.
Uh-uh. Oh, I know you went to Northwestern.
No.
I thought you started it.
No, no, I've never gone to Missoula.
You went
so. In fact, Bozeman gave me an honorary degree, so my loyalty is to Bozeman.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Here I was thinking all of how you went straight from Bollier High School to...
No, I went straight to Northwestern.
And you didn't have a hard time at all.
No, it was all strange getting off the train in Chicago, seeing the first cobblestone street of my life. In Evanston, where Northwestern is, at the old train station. That was the only one in town, I guess. But, you know...
Didn't have to go to Europe to
see it. No, didn't have to do any of that, so...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, as I think towards trying to find distinctive small things about Montana, I come up with things like the white crosses that mark the auto fatalities, which you don't see elsewhere in South Carolina.
They're trying to start that up again, aren't they?
Are they?
They've quit for a while.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Think.
I think that makes you a little cautious.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So somebody went out to the corner.
Yeah, yeah. And the big sky on the mud flaps and out here.
Some place over here around Stanford, they have flowers on those crosses.
Yeah.
Like
artificial flowers.
Yeah.
Kind of
Don't
Mexicans do that down in Mexico?
I think they do. I've read that.
I've never seen it around here, but I know on that highway by Stanford, there's quite a few.
Well, it sure makes me remember different people I knew that were killed out on this road to this side of Ringling.
Mm-hmm.
My friend Doris Nash got killed.
Well, that's right.
And every time I see the cross there, I think she was trying to get from here over to Bozeman in time for dinner at 6, and I think it was 4 when she was here.
Uh-huh.
And she was just roaring down the road and hit a poor innocent guy that didn't think anybody was in the area and made a turn.
Yeah.
Maybe you remember Dr. Nash.
I do, yeah. I can remember when that accident happened, in fact, yeah. Right. But I'd be interested in what you guys see as that you notice in Montana and don't see elsewhere when anything that...
I haven't been anywhere in Montana.
Even back in St. Catharines. Big belt buckles. I'm wearing one. Norma Ashby gave me one.
She
did. I was on a TV show.
I don't see Norma anymore. They switched her time or something.
They changed her to...
12 o'clock?
Yeah, high noon. I
used to watch her every morning.
Yeah, that was the station changed ownership.
Yeah.
And they changed all that.
She's pretty good.
Well,
she is good.
We never turn it on during the day, but we'd have it on for the news in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and wait and hear what Norma Ashby had to say.
Yeah.
And then, but I suppose a lot of people would be gone to work by then.
It seems to me that...
We got on the program at one time.
That was terrific. Because...
You were in there too.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
You remember Vic Miller?
Remember the name.
Well, Isabel Chopin or Isabel Duncan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Vic Miller was her son, and he did real well down in Billings in TV. And at that particular time, he was in charge of the deal where they could show it all over the state.
Uh-huh.
And he just switched them on. And I think his mother told him or something, because I don't know why he'd do it otherwise. Or maybe because we're in Hoytzel. But anyway, we had all state coverage. And I had people from Sydney telling me how beautifully it came in. But you know, here something went wrong with our transformer or something. Didn't come in
the light sulfur? Oh,
and people were gathering and going to have coffee together and watch it. It was terrible. But out of Sydney and most places.
So you got statewide fame, but not local fame. Well, you didn't
and
need
I
local
have,
fame.
Yeah. But you know, I never thought much about it until Lee Rostad.
She's got a new book on
that. And so she asked Norma, she said, you know, you sure helped us that time before. And would you give me an interview? And Norma Ashby said, well, you know, you won't get state anymore.
Uh-huh.
I'd be just grateful.
Uh-huh.
We just have a new book out.
And I'm just kind of worried about it. I've got the company.
Okay.
We'll get it.
You're on Norma's show for your book then, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now what did she ask you and so forth? What was that like?
She's a marvelous person.
Uh-huh.
Because we went early. There was Lee Frosted and her husband, Fred Mee. We stayed overnight, grateful. We went over there and she just sits there and at a little table and talks to you before you go on. And you just feel, kind of get slow, you just sitting there chatting.
And down. I always kind of nervous.
She's
real nice.
She just comes
when she
down.
Got on, she was real calm.
But what happened was...
Lee was a little nervous. But.
Well, they took the focus off of me because Lee and Sonny Rostad all went to Missoula with Norma.
Yeah, yeah.
And they knew the same people. So they sat there talking about, you know, here's a little me sitting there. No, I didn't know anybody. But... they weren't looking at me or paying any attention to me, so that was fine.
So you relaxed.
And then she had me read that little piece that St. Kate's published, a little about the present of Christmas. And I had to read it. If I had known I was going to do that, I would have died.
Right.
But
that's why she didn't tell you.
That's why she didn't.
Yeah, I got through with it, and then she picked up some of the conversation we'd have at the table, because I was telling her I got a letter from Paul Ringling, and he was objecting to my saying that the hole in the lamp down at the Ringling house had a big Tiffany lamp in the dining room had a hole in it. And I said that it had, it was bulletproof. And so he wrote me a letter, and he said, Teresa, I object to that because it was, what was it that caused it now? Something very insane. It wasn't a bulletproof.
Oh.
And so then she started quizzing, well, how about that hole in that lamp? You know, she's so good that way.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to be on her program related to Art Watson.
Yes.
And so Shirley Watson was the one that got us on for Norma.
Yeah.
She talked to her.
She,
and so that's how we got
there. She was born and raised over here at Winston's.
Yeah.
Where the Watsons were.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's how she.
Yeah, she's coming up on her 25th year on this program.
Yeah.
I think it's this year or next.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it sure is. And sure, a lot of people...
She knew how to handle that pretty good.
Sure. A lot of people...
I wonder if she's going to be active in the Charlie Russell's auction this year.
I don't know.
Comes up in March.
I don't know.
She's always so busy with
that. Yeah, she loves Project.
I thought that fellow's going around the state. I'm not saying Charlie Russell, he's got that thing down pretty good.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
somebody
doing
a one-man
show.
Who's this guy?
He was down here to, Hobby Club.
Christmas.
He put on the singer stuff from here with Charlie Russell.
Uh-huh.
Well, he entertains for dinner parties.
Uh-huh.
And all he has for his properties that Voyager sash.
Yeah.
And we have one of those. And he said, where'd you get it? And I said, my sister sent clear to Canada for it. He said, that's where you have to send.
Uh-huh.
And he has a Voyager sash and then this battered hat.
Yeah.
And then he's constantly either had a paintbrush in his hand rolling around or rolling a cigarette.
Does he kind of look like Russell?
Oh. No, he's too chubby.
Too chubby.
He has a double chin.
What
but his voice is just typical old man's voice,
uh-huh.
just rambling on.
Yeah.
And then all of them is talking. He has this big screen behind him, and they're flat. They put up these pictures, different famous ones like Brown for Breakfast and everything.
Yeah.
And then what he's telling relates to that.
Uh huh.
And it's a really neat show.
Uh huh.
He's got something going.
And he isn't in Montana. He comes from Wisconsin.
Is that right? He saw a possibility in Charlie Russell.
But he's connected with old Grand Street Theater and Arts Council. We have an Arts Council here now.
Is that right?
And believe it or not, in March we're going to have Evening of Ballet. They have now farmed.
Where are they coming from? Where?
Bozeman. Yeah. They have looked, they have just farmed, and they call it the Montana Ballet Company.
Mm-hmm.
And they're coming over to put on a program.
Well, you want to get all these guys at gunpoint and get them down there and make them sit through that, too. Have an audience.
Well, we've had Shakespeare in the Park.
Yeah, I know. That's been very successful around the state, I guess. I think Montana does really well with this sort of thing.
I think so, too. There are all sorts of things going. I suppose it's grant money.
Well, it's largely National Humanities. National Endowment for the Humanities. It's federal.
Oh, yeah.
Federal
yeah.
money, by and large.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that is starting to get cut with the new grant.
We have an arts council that meets on Thursday mornings. I don't know how many times.
Early in the morning.
At 7 o'clock in the morning at the truck stop for breakfast.
Uh-huh.
And last
very fitting.
Last Thursday I made it. And the newspaper gal was there, and the little Mary Karen Grandy, her spot, you know, Andy Grandy,
mm-hmm.
her she's in ballet.
Oh, okay.
And she's on the board for the Montana Ballet. Then Dale McAfee, who is restoring the Colburn House.
Yeah. I know who he is.
Oh, well, he's an ex-ballet dancer.
Oh, he is. Oh.
That's
okay.
A strange little walk. I don't know.
Well, ballet dancers.
But he's got, well, it is the Colburn House, historically. Walt Colburn was born in one of the rooms upstairs. And he is redoing that whole thing just so meticulously, you wouldn't believe it. Patty and I were over there the other afternoon. They'd removed the wainscoting in one of the rooms. It was thin boards, narrow boards.
Yeah.
And they had been stained and beat up. And they had sanded them down to it just like new, in the back up. And he has the original stairway and the newel post. Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
There's beautiful detail in there.
So he's
and his front door is just gorgeous, has a fan light. He waited 9 months, he said, for this fan light. It's lit.
So he's living there, is he?
Well, he hasn't moved in yet.
But he's restoring
he's
the place for himself.
He's there, and I don't know.
He's going to have a bed and breakfast.
Yeah, he says,
we're here.
And I said, what are you going to call it? And he said, well, I think I'm going to call it the Pillars.
Pillars.
I think he should have a more nostalgic name.
Mm.
Like, because he's restoring an old house.
Yeah.
I said, how about Colburn House? And he said, well, they didn't do anything to save it.
It's not too hot on.
That's really something,
yeah.
This restoration that's going on. Because he's cleaned the
brick.
Oh, yeah.
Hmm.
He has money, and I don't know where he does.
Boy.
Unless he could be getting something from the restoration fund. This dark restoration.
Well,
but would it be that important?
I don't think he could get it for a private house like that. Don't believe so.
Well, maybe that's why he's having a bed and breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
We have another bed and breakfast place, the old park.
That did come to pass?
Yeah, and it's just darling.
Yeah, fixed up.
I know.
We were down there for...
I think he's doing all right here on the hunters and the skiers.
Who's running that?
Dempsey. Shane Dempsey.
Shane Dempsey, yeah.
Shane Dempsey.
Yeah. Huh.
And he is a really nice guy.
Is he? Uh-huh.
And I don't know whether he gets much business.
I think he has
a wonderful
skier.
Package. Yeah,
he's
skiing.
Got a package.
That's another thing that's
skiers.
Changed.
They come here from hell or wherever they come from, and they stay a couple of nights. Which days is Friday and Saturday they ski.
Mm-hmm. Is that for Kings Hill?
Yeah, that's Kings Hill.
They call it Showdown now.
That's the only place that had good snow this winter.
Is that a gambling term? It is, isn't it?
Showdown. It's Showdown. Nyhart.
I thought it was a gambling term.
I don't know. It's a military term of kinds, but I'm trying to think if there is a kind of
Kings Hill,
kind of poker.
But it's a real neat package deal. And it's much, it really gets people in. They can stay overnight and have breakfast and a dinner the night before and skiing up at the hill. It's all together.
I see.
George, what's George's name? George Wilkins.
$35 or what is it? Must be more than that.
Must be more than that.
And skiing's been awfully good at Showdown this year.
Huh.
Rick and our granddaughter, Mary, she goes to Carol.
Maybe it's 70 over
and
she took her
dad. Made Rick go skiing. He loves to ski, but he never has time.
Right.
Now I think he'll start again.
Good. How's he doing?
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Worries about how heavy he is.
Oh.
In hair and
paying income tax.
Paying income tax.
Oh.
You know, one of the ranchers are about ready to move out of here. He's got a pretty good hold.
Another thing that's new in here is
the whole loophole and all that.
Cross-country skiing. That is a really big deal.
Cross-country.
And a lot of people are getting the cross-country. But the Showdown up here, they have another package deal with the school. Now, our two little grandchildren, Megan Knight, that's Jack Knight, Megan and George, they're in the fourth and fifth grade. And they, every Tuesday, they go, once a week, they take them off the buses.
Oh, I see.
And they take their lunch, and then they can rent the equipment. And it's all a little package here. But they have done very well up there, sure. So recreation is moving in here very fast.
Yeah. Now, the pulp industry, is it entirely out of here now? It's totally
pulled right out. After we fixed the schools
to town,
and I
watch out the window in the mornings, there's logs, semi-loads of logs. Either go to Townsend or Livingston. They go right out of here.
So they're still cutting up here.
Oh, they're cutting. They're taking our timber. Going out of here.
Not leaving any jobs.
No. Just the truck is.
They come roaring down our main street, loaded with logs, and head right up.
Yeah, that really.
Either good or
time. And it was a nice little mill. People that knew about mills that came in for that sale said that there was nothing wrong with it. It was new. They just had done it over recently. But it was just out and out greediness on the part of that Livingston.
Well, that was a deal behind the scenes. They wanted to take it to Livingston.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They destroyed it. But they didn't sell and burned up.
Is that right?
No one would want to ever go back there again.
Yeah.
I think that's a terrible thing.
That's pretty rotten. Yeah.
Well, now we're at school. School attendance gone down now on account of that.
Yeah, I imagine so.
Yeah.
Is it?
They had us building buildings because we had how many kids on it gone.
Yeah.
I guess that happens all over.
I wonder how the attendance compares with when Susan and I were there. Is it back towards that kind of level, I wonder? Or?
I think it is. Probably back.
I imagine it would be if all those loggers pulled out and so on.
The attendance?
Yeah, school attendance and so forth.
Back when he was
I don't know, but we're kind of a forward going school here. They had the other day what they called demonstration of for talented and gifted children.
Mm-hmm.
And it was first that they had in any place around this area. Well, quite a large area because there were teachers here from Whitefish. And they had it in this gym. And all the different work the children had done. And it was very interesting. Neva Lou Johnston was in charge of it. And I don't know how she did it, because all while poor Jim was still dying, I guess. She was tearing back and forth with him. And
I think it was quite a bit larger when you were supervising. We have more superintendents in a way.
Yeah.
We got more of those.
Yeah, I suppose.
We got some extra ones, I think.
Yeah.
But the kids are more organized. Now, Patty has started, she started out with 4-H for her kids. They have 60 kids in this 4-H. Everybody wants to join because they wear jackets and 4-H on the bag and the name. And they, the other day, they took them in 2 busloads to the winter fair. And they take them all around showing things. One of the ranch ladies is teaching them how to take care of horses. And they have a horsemanship group, and they perform. And anytime there's a performance, they're out there with their horses.
How many is in high school now? How many kids in high school?
I think so.
One time we were in the B district, and We got back and see you.
Yeah.
Boy.
Yeah.
After the mill left, we went back to see
you. Uh-huh.
So I think that's about normal.
Yeah. That's close.
Huh. You remember you and Susan in school?
Well, let's see. We were in the high school class of 57.
57.
Yeah. Right. So.
That's quite a while ago.
Yeah, it's going to be a while ago, too.
A little bit
well,
back.
You were in Susan.
Yes, right. I did not graduate from here, but
that was the classroom.
Yeah, yeah. So, do they ever have high school? Do they have high school class reunions here or anything?
Of Susan's? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's see. I don't think they've had one for an awful long time.
Yeah. My class up at Valair is quite scrupulous about every 5 years.
Yeah.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. We've got one guy.
Hey, Valair's have. That area up there is really having the time of the Grizzlies, aren't they?
I guess they are in there north of Shoto, yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a feedlot in there just north of Shoto.
That brings a bird.
And they had a day and a half of east wind, which is pretty rare up in that country. And apparently it just filled that Rocky Mountain front with feedlot odor. And the Grizzlies
the beef down there.
They smell that beef down there.
That's what brought them.
That was the original thing about a year and a half ago, and they hit Bud Guthrie's son's sheep on the way, and they hit somebody's honeycombs.
He's kind of against his father.
Yeah.
He thinks the bears are right.
Yeah.
Something
like they have fallen out years past, not just over bears.
Been on the paper quite a bit here lately.
Yeah. Right. So.
I don't blame him. I don't want to eat my sheep either.
That does bother you.
Beyond Six Wheels, and that line is sure to speak in the pages of some future book of mine. There is simply no telling how long Tony Hunault will go on speaking in my pages by way of library ventriloquism. There are just a couple of more stanzas I thought you might hear. And the first of them, I guess, is a world premiere of sorts. It's a few paragraphs from the book I'm writing now, the Montana novel that goes back to the late 19th century and World War I, and it's not been heard in public before. It is an early draft, far from final polish, but I thought by now, after hearing my vagaries about what a writer does in libraries, you could stand some reassurance that the material you provide does end up somewhere, in some more or less systematic way. So I thought I would read these few new paragraphs, then briefly show the library research that helped produce them. This is Scotland again. My narrator, Angus MacCaskill, and his chum, Robert Burns Barclay, are emigrating to America, to Montana. They are in line with the other steerage passengers of mourning in 1889, on a dock at the port city of Greenock, at the mouth of the River Clyde. They're waiting to board the steamship James Watt, which is not a namesake of the unlamented former Secretary of the Interior, but of the Scottish inventor of the steam engine. The standing in line is tedious. Angus and his buddy are both of us 19 and green as the cheese of the moon, and trying our double damnedest not to show it. Angus himself is afraid of water, cannot swim, and there's 10 days of the Atlantic Ocean ahead. And here is what begins running through his mind. Awful, what a person lets himself do to himself. There I stood on that Greenock dock, wanting more than anything else in this world not to step aboard that iron ship, and wanting just as desperately to do so. Oh, I knew what was wrestling in me. We had a book, Crowfoot's Transatlantic Emigrant's Guide, and my ailment was in it. Crowfoot was our instructor that a shilling was worth 24 American cents, and what postal stamps cost there in the big country, and that when it was midnight in Scotland, the clocks of Montana were striking just 5 of the afternoon. Crowfoot told this, too. Do not emigrate in a fever, but consider the question in every aspect. The mother country must be left behind, the family ties, the old associations broken. Be sure that you look at the dark side of the picture. The broad Atlantic, the dusty ride to the great west, the scorching sun, the cold winter, coldest you ever experienced, and the hard work. But if you finally, with your eyes open, decide to emigrate, do it with no divided heart. Right advice, Angus goes on, to keep your heart in one pure peace, but easier seen than followed, at least in my case. I knew I oughtn't, but I turned and looked up the river, east up the great broad trough of the Clyde. East into yesterday, may as well say, for it was only the day before that the pair of us, Rob and I, had been hurled almost all the way across Scotland by train from Nethermuir into Glasgow. A further train across the Clyde Bridge, westward alongside mile upon mile of the river's tide flats and their smell. Then here came Greenock to us, all its shipyards and docks, the chimney stalks of its sugar refineries, its sharp church spires, and high, high above all, its municipal tower of crisp new stone, the color of pie crust. It took just that first look to know Greenock was a more going town than our old Nethermuir could be in 10 centuries. For night, we bedded where the emigration agent had advised, the model lodging house, which may have been a model of something, but lodging wasn't it. Then this morning, Greenock, true to reputation, waking into rain, but every Scotsman has seen rain before, and so off we set, to ask our way to the Cumbrae Lines Moorage, to the steamship James Watt, and to be told in a Clydeside gabble it took the both of us to understand, "The Jemmy lads, ye want to gae doon to Patrick Street." And there at the foot of Patrick Street was the Albert Harbour. There was the green-funneled steam swimmer to America. There were the two of us. So, I am often asked, where does stuff like that come from? Where indeed? But here's where at least some of those phrases had their origin. We had a book, Crowfoot's Transatlantic Emigrant's Guide. Edinburgh, the National Library of Scotland, had emigration guides of the late 19th century, not all of them as bombastic as the version I've given my young voyagers, but one of them does have that glorious line, "Do it with no divided heart." The pair of us had been hurled almost all the way across Scotland by train. St. Andrews, the basement, an old ordnance gazetteer of Scotland, tells me that my young men of 1889 would have ridden the Caledonian Railway to the port of Greenock. As a passenger line, the Caledonian takes high rank, its stations embracing all the 8 large towns of Scotland. Here came Greenock to us, all its shipyards and docks, the chimney stalks, and so on. Greenock itself, the Watt Library, with its historic photos of Greenock in its heyday, before a channel was dredged in the River Clyde upstream to Glasgow. We bedded in the model lodging house, St. Andrews, the basement again, a pocket history and guide to the Scottish town of Brechin, which had such an imaginatively named place to stay, which may have been a model of something, but lodging wasn't it. That same pocket history provides the information that out of 3,276 men who stayed overnight sometime during that year, no fewer than 1,100 went to bed under the influence of liquor. Off we set to the steamship James Watt, Glasgow, the Mitchell Library, where from the old Lloyd's registers of ships, Carol put together for me the dimensions and speed and deck layouts and even the color scheme of a typical emigrant steamship of the time. To be told in a Clydeside gabble, "The Jemmy lads, ye want to gae doon to Barrack Street." Glasgow and the Mitchell Library again. Here I was trying to get at the fact that as soon as you leave home, the world begins to sound different. And in Scotland, The residents of Glasgow and the nearby towns along the Clyde River have the reputation of sounding mysterious even to other Scots, which is saying a lot. The Glasgow film Gregory's Girl was dubbed with a new soundtrack for American audiences. Anyway, in trying to hear the Glaswegian dialect for the sake of this scene in my novel, I came onto a study of Scottish dialects which told me that a distinctive Glasgow sound is what's called a glottal stop, a kind of swallowing of the letter T. The example given was the Glaswegian who introduces himself to you. My name is Pat Patterson, with two T's. And so from visiting nearby Greenock and finding in the library material there that the Clydeside steamships for America had left from the Albert Harbor at the foot of Patrick Street, I had my chance to put that half-baffling bit of dialect into my character's ears. I want to end this talk in the next few minutes on a note such as you might find in a love song. For the fact seems to be, as I look back over my behavior as a writer, that I'm infatuated with libraries. There's more to it than that. There always is in affairs of the heart, divided or otherwise. Time after time, I have loved libraries not just for themselves, but for the company they keep. I think of the Alaska Historical Library in Juneau during my Sea Runners research, of how I would take a break there by going out onto a balcony of that building above Juneau and watching the white cruise ships come up Gastineau Channel between the dark timbered avalanche of the Alaskan mountains. It was like stepping directly from the library to a mountaintop. And I remember more years ago, after a morning spent in the reading room of the British Museum, a lunchtime. On the other side of Great Russell Street was a pub which shrewdly called itself the Museum Tavern. You can hear the domestic dialogues that choice of name created. And where have you been this long while? Where have I been? I was in the museum. Well, in I went, sat at the end of the bar, ordered a smoked salmon sandwich and a half of bitter. Next to me sat a huge character who was chatting with the bartender and his young helper. I sat, sipping and munching, in that snug harbor so close by the British Museum's ocean of books. The bartender went to tend customers at the far end of the bar. The huge character leaned in on the young helper and said, "You've got the money now?" The young helper nodded nervously. The huge character ordered, "Give it me, with the change for my next pint." I realized that I was seeing a loan shark at work, and I fervently hoped that he was going to go on ignoring me, the invisible American. The young helper grew even more nervous. Instead of passing his payoff to the shark with the change for a drink, he turned his body and shoved the money across the bar. The shark snatched it and disappeared just as the bartender looked down the bar, knowing he had seen something happened. I went back to the reading room of the British Museum with the reminder that not all the world's stories were in its books. And I think back again to Scotland last summer, to Glasgow. The people of Glasgow, the Glaswegians, have a reputation as the Cockneys or the Brooklynese of Scotland. And while British person after British person told us we would find Glasgow generally hospitable enough in a raffish kind of way, for heaven's sake, Carol and I, we naive library types, must never go into the pubs in that city of hard men. I spent a first morning in Glasgow's Mitchell Library, a sleek enterprise which proclaims itself the largest public reference library in Europe, and likely is. Carol met me and said, "I think I found us a lunch place." It was a mere half block away, and it was called the Ritz Bar, and of course it was a pub. In we went to a place of gleaming dark wood and gorgeous high pressed tin ceiling, and the most orderly of clientele, and impeccable service, which included the motherly cook coming out of the kitchen to ask us, "Is the soup all right, dears?" Fearsome Glasgow pubs, eh? May they take over the world. I don't know what you make of incidents such as these, but I suggest that it's no coincidence that memorable watering holes so often come to mind together with memorable libraries. After all, aren't librarians the bartenders of information? Behind your polished wood, don't you deal with all manner of customers who step in through that door from the street? Aren't strange concoctions ordered up from you? Don't you see almost every sort of human behavior and begin regularly to recite the ancient prayer that must have originated in a pub somewhere? Please, Lord, not on my shift. And don't you preside over shelves of intoxicating items, some of which are never opened until the day a bearded customer comes in and asks, "Do you have a brand called Doig's Law?" And at closing time, isn't there a cosmic chorus of librarians, all of you saying wearily to yourselves, "At least I helped humankind make it through one more day"? That's what I hear.